listening to the Lutheran Ladies Lounge podcast. I'm Sarah.
I'm Erin.
And I'm Rachel.
We have a very special episode for you today. We promised this 2 weeks ago, if you remember, if you're listening to the podcast. Otherwise, it was yesterday, if you were one of the three of us, that we're doing a book club extended edition. Rachel, who is joining us today?
We are so blessed to have with us in the lounge today, the Reverend Dr. Ryan P. Tinetti. Dr. Tinetti is professor of practical theology at Concordia Seminary, St. Louis, and author of our most recent book club pick, The Quiet Ambition, Scripture's Surprising Antidote to Our Restless Lives. Dr. Tinetti, thank you for being with us today.
It is my pleasure. Thank you for having me in the lounge.
Yes, it's actually not that often that we have dudes in the lounge, so I hope you enjoy the experience.
It is a special privilege, it's true.
Yeah, yes, thank you.
So we have very much enjoyed reading and discussing your book together. It is one that speaks to a lot of our hearts, and I just want to start by asking you, where did this book come from, and why were you inspired to write it?
Yeah, so, well, I mean, first and foremost, it came from my own life of faith and following Christ. I teach preaching here at the seminary. And one of the things I always tell my students is, first, you got to preach to yourself before you can preach to God's people. If that message isn't resonating in your own heart, then it's not going to connect to them as well. And so this is something that I've struggled with in my own life of how can I slow down? So I definitely lean more toward the restlessness of go, 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 do, do, do. And there's been just a number of moments throughout my life that have really called my attention to it. And I'll just share one quick anecdote. This was a few years back. We were on a family road trip from Washington State down to California. And like any good dad, my number one goal was to make good time. Like nobody knows what good time is, but we just, dads, it's just deep in our fiber. I have to make good time. And I was making great time until I saw the lights going behind me.
And
too good of time. And you know, my little daughter's like, Daddy, why is the police officer pulling you over? He just wants to chat, I think, just to talk. And I don't think he was like a professional philosopher, but he asked me this question that just cut me to the heart. He simply said, you know, sir, why are you in such a hurry?
Oh.
And I think he wanted to know why my speed was what it was on the road. But in that moment, it was like, oh, why am I in such a hurry? And there had been things going on at church and in ministry. And in fact, I was on this trip because one of my elders had said, hey, dude, you're about to burn out. You need to go on a vacation. And on my vacation, I'm preoccupied with making good time and getting pulled over. That's not the only example I could tell you. It's an ongoing kind of struggle. But then also the other side of it is just, I've been a pastor now for 16 years, and I've seen throughout my years of ministry, whether you're talking about in the parish or even, you know, teaching as at the seminary, how God's people have this gnawing question at them, which is, I want my life to matter. I want to make a difference. And yet I'm so small. My life is so little and God's cosmos and kingdom is so vast. What difference can I really make? And it's a good question. It's an important question. And if it doesn't get good, sound, biblical answers, it can lead people into some dark places where you really wonder, does it all matter? And so that's why I wrote.
Oh, that's so great. I like to say, if people ask me who's your arch nemesis, I say my own finitude.
Yeah, yes.
That is the thing that I wrestle with.
Right.
There are infinite opportunities to serve my God and my neighbor.
Mm-hmm.
And yet I am this little tiny ant of a human being crawling along the face of the earth, trying to do as much as I can and restless.
Yes.
Now, I do want to talk a little bit about that restlessness, because you mentioned it in the title, and it appears very early in the book, where you say that this quiet desperation infects people in one of two ways, and both of them are malformed ambitions.
That's right.
The restless ambition, which I think probably you and I and Sarah and Erin half the time, if you listened to the episode 2 weeks ago, you'll know about this, suffer from this restless ambition, but then there's also what you call resigned ambition. So Walk us through these two definitions here.
Yeah. So, I mean, as I was first kind of conceiving of the book, the restlessness, that was a no-brainer. That's what I struggle with my own self more so. But as I dug deeper into it and reflected on my pastoral experience and think conversations that were happening in the culture, I realized there's really two ways that this can go. That when you're struggling with that sense of, does my life matter? Does it make a difference, et cetera? One response is, yeah, to press the pedal to the metal and to go even harder. But the other answer, which sadly we're seeing more and more in our world today, is people just tapping out and saying, no, I'm going to resign. And in fact, Thoreau himself, you mentioned the quiet desperation, that phrase famously comes from Thoreau. He says, the quiet desperation is confirmed resignation. It's when you are simply saying, I am not going to have anything to do with this. And you've especially seen it among young men in our society,
right?
Where there's just a kind of failure to launch. And whether it be the stereotypical living in the parents' basement or just spending more time online and disengaging from real life. But it's not exclusively young men. It can be people from any walk of life. And I think I talk about in the book, but pre-COVID, for the first time in more than 100 years in this country, there was a decline in life expectancy. Mm-hmm. For 3 years in a row, life expectancy was going down. For the longest time, it had been growing. Mm-hmm. And the reason was, it wasn't because of heart disease. It wasn't because of the typical things that take people out. It was because of the increase of what are called deaths of despair, mm-hmm. of people who are dying by their own hand or indirectly mm-hmm. through substance abuse, effects of loneliness and isolation, and so on and so forth. And to me, that's the other dark side to that coin of the restless ambition and the resigned mm-hmm. ambition.
Mm-hmm. What is it about our culture that is, I don't know, causing more people to have that, the resigned side? Mm-hmm. I mean, I grew up definitely in an era of like, do more all the time. Right. You're right. There's been this slow little like shift into just checking out.
Yeah.
What do you think? What have you seen?
I think part of it is more the sense of what you should do. You should be able to do all the things and have all the things. And certainly social media has aggravated this sense where you see it out there and it seems like friends or acquaintances, people you knew once upon a time, that kid who was always bullying you in middle school and now is super successful. And you're like, Lord, why do the wicked prosper? And so it's up, it's in your face, where you think of in a pre-internet sort of age and you have as your context, the people in your own community, and you could have your own baselines and standards from your family and from your own conscience, from your congregation, ways that you want to thrive and succeed, but you're not constantly having rubbed in your face all the things you're not doing or not doing enough of or not doing well enough of, et cetera. And I think that has to be a big part of it. It's probably not the only thing, but I think that's part of it for sure.
You're right. We were just talking in a meeting the other day about my despair as a home educator when I see other parents post about their children's, 63 college credits that they're graduating
that's
high
right.
school with from dual enrollment. And I'm just like, but I can't do that.
Right. That's right.
Oh, the comparison game.
For sure.
Right, yeah. The social media and the internet definitely has made the comparison game like exponentially more than
right.
it used to be mm-hmm. for sure. Ugh.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about what you identify as the antidote to all of this malformed ambition and quiet desperation. And tell us how we fix it.
Well, it's Jesus is the answer.
There we go.
So,
end of the podcast. We're done.
Thank
there we
you.
Go.
Hardest ever.
Yes. So there's many ways we can answer this. But the way that I answered it is came about through one of these just great, I think you guys can resonate with me on this, just those moments of studying the scripture where you come across something that you didn't see before.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You know, like you've got 80% of it highlighted, but here's this one random verse that wasn't highlighted. And so you just kind of overlooked it. And for me, it was in one of these personal studies in 1 Thessalonians, which also we have to admit is not as high on the power rankings of Paul's epistles. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got Galatians, Romans, 1 Corinthians. Thessalonians doesn't get as much love sometimes, but 1 Thessalonians and reading through that letter, and it's this beautiful epistle where Paul is kind of, he talks about himself as a spiritual father, and it's almost a kind of dad talk where he's trying to encourage them in the life of faith. And he was concerned that his work had been in vain, that they had perhaps renounced their faith. They were facing opposition. And then he learns, he gets the word back from Timothy. No, actually, it's all signs go. Like things are going really well for the Thessalonians. And he paints this beautiful picture in 1 Thessalonians 4 of the coming of Christ, the return of the Lord, the renewal of all creation, the resurrection. And it's like this grand, glorious image of what's to come. Right before that is this very mundane word of wisdom from Paul when he says, hey, make it your ambition to live quietly, tend your own business, and work with your hands. This is my own translation of it, so that you might walk gracefully toward outsiders and have need of nothing. And for me, it was like coming across this passage that when I read it, it was like a breath of fresh air. When I can feel like my calling as a Christian is I've got to be doing these great, grand things, changing the world. And Paul's like, hey, listen, actually just take the garbage out, you know, be nice to your neighbors, like try to show Jesus love a little bit more in your home. And I've come to think of it as the quiet ambition, making your ambition to live quietly. And I think that it can be an antidote to that quiet desperation as we lean into the life of hope in our everyday life.
Okay, so what does it mean to live quietly? Because I am not a quiet person. Maybe in like large crowds, I'm quiet, but anyone who knows me personally knows that I am not. I'm a loud person. Yeah. What does that mean?
Good. Please don't feel judged by that, Sarah. Like this is not a...
Too late. She already feels judged by that. I can see it in her face.
It's not a referendum on temperament or personality. Okay. It's not extrovert versus introvert. Nor is it what I think can sometimes be a misunderstanding, like the quiet life is, you know, peace and quiet. Mm. Or you remember, I mean, my mind goes to, and as I've had conversations with people, like the Thomas Kincaid paintings. You remember the Thomas Kincaid paintings where the painter of light, and it's always just some cottage that is lit up from inside. It might be on fire, but I mean, it looks very peaceful. And it's beside a mountain and a waterfall. And, you know, it's like Tina Fey used to say on 30 Rock, like, I want to go to there.
Uh-huh. Right. Yeah. And that is when you talk about the quiet life, the first thing I think about is, well, I better go buy my tiny house and start my homestead in the country.
That's right.
Live my best Wendell Berry life now.
Exactly. Right? And if you have that, more power to you. Although I say,
I do not, in fact, have that, nor is it particularly within my reach.
And most of us don't. And I recount in the book how before coming to the seminary, I served for a number of years as a pastor in the town was literally called Arcadia, which is like, you know, it's the Greek vision of the unspoiled wilderness. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just this beautiful place. And Arcadia is a beautiful place, especially in the summertime. But I remember when we first moved there and we're in this kind of remote country setting, like, oh, it's so peaceful. And I went out for a morning walk. This was in the fall and there's the crisp sound of the leaves and it's beautiful. It's real early though. And the next thing I know, I hear pop, 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 like gunshots. What's happening? You'll hit the deck.
And that's not a 22 gunshot either.
No.
Like a 30 out six there.
Yeah, that's right. Well, it was November 15th, which for Michiganders is opening day to hunting season.
A big deal.
It's a big deal. Yep. And as soon as it hits, I don't know if it was when the sun's up or if it's 7 o'clock, it was something like that. It's early in the morning. Suddenly you can go hunting. Mm-hmm. And for me, it was just kind of, it deromanticized a little bit the sense of the peace and quiet that you thought you have. And we could talk about other country things versus urban things. There, suffice it to say, there is noise pretty much everywhere. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And living quietly is not just about getting away from it all. It's more about a gift of grace. It's the posture of faith, of living in relationship with the Lord, where, you know, scriptures talk about this. It's the quietness, in quietness and trust is your strength, it says in Isaiah 30. Or, you know, I recount the Israelites on the precipice of the Red Sea. And when the Lord says through Moses, like, listen, while you guys are whining and crying about how Pharaoh's breathing down your neck, be still, stand firm, see the salvation of the Lord. You only have to be quiet, mm-hmm. just sort of like, just, you know, zip it. But also, like, this is what it looks like to live quietly, is to lean on the Lord, to have that spirit that can trust in him. And so it's not a matter of circumstance. It's a matter of the spirit within us.
Thank you so much for clarifying. I live in a house with three adolescent females in a neighborhood that is equidistant from a rail yard, a shipyard, an airport, and a major interstate.
Oh my goodness.
And like this quietness has got to be a state of mind, because it certainly isn't my external reality.
Right.
And so it's really good to hear you clarify that you're talking about a state of spiritual quietness.
Yeah.
Although there is silence that is involved in it. And I that's where I would love to take the conversation next. You identify the noisemakers that get in the way of us living quietly as Christians. What kind of noisemakers do you have in mind?
Yeah. So, oh gosh, there are so many. This was a section of the book where I really had to limit myself.
I could feel that. I could definitely sense that in reading the chapter.
Yep. I wanted to just get some kind of representative stuff. So the first and foremost, we do have to say that there's just a lot of noise, like literal physical noise in our world. And it behooves all of us, to the extent that we are able, to try and find some measure modicum of solitude and quiet. And that can be hard to find. It can be hard to find if you're in an urban setting or a suburban setting. It can be hard to find if your life is just filled with a lot of noise. And I'm with you, Rachel. I've got kids at home, and sometimes it drives me up a wall. But at the same token, I wouldn't trade it, right?
Like, oh my goodness, no, not at all.
Yeah.
I love it.
And it's just, I also need a little bit of quiet time in there too. And so that's the first noisemaker, though. It's just straight up noise. And whether you're talking about the beeps and the bustle, or you're talking about the pings and the dings and all of our smart things. I didn't mean to be a poet here, but it is.
That's nice. Well done.
Thank you. And so that's one of the noisemakers. Another one of the noisemakers, and it goes hand in hand with this, is our devices, right? Mm-hmm. Of just the things that are constantly doing the pinging and the dinging. Mm-hmm. And it's not just our phones, but now everything is smart. Mm. Smart dishwashers, smart refrigerators, everything's talking to you, your phone, your watch. You know, everything is so smart. Mm. So smart. Why can't you just do the laundry for me?
But so great.
it's all of those devices that are just creating so much noise. And it's noise. If we think of noise, I quote in the book from the statistician Nate Silver, who, it's his job to think about noise. And he says, noise is anything that distracts us from the signal. He says, the signal is the truth.
Mm.
And he's not speaking theologically, but as Christians, you can hear that the noise in our lives is whatever that distracts us from the truth of God.
Mm-hmm.
And so it could be just the loudness in our lives. It can be devices, but it can also be cluttered calendars.
Mm.
It can be the noise in our schedules. Just there's so much going on. There's no white space that it can be really hard to find that time to listen to the Lord. And maybe the last thing I'll say is, it can be, all of those tend to be more external. We can think, well, again, the problem's just out there, but the problem's in our hearts too. It can be the discontent in our hearts, just that sense of the fear of missing out and all the stuff that I need or should be doing. Or it can be that accusing voice of the evil one, the noise in our heads and our spirits, where Satan, with his accusatory, you know, wagging finger, trying to get at us. We see this in the scripture. But to ultimately know, to live quietly, is to trust that the voice that matters most is the voice of my good shepherd.
Mm.
And I'm simply his sheep. That's what I want to listen to.
Mm-hmm. I like the addition of also like visual noise and internal noise, all of that can be distracting, especially with devices. I mean, my phone's been on silent for years at this point. Like, I know what my ringtone sounds like, but it only happens a few times a year when like my security system at home makes my phone turn on because we accidentally set our alarm off in our house. That's the only time I know what my finger sounds like. So it's not just the auditory noise that's distracting. It's everything around us. It's the clutter. It's the visual stuff. It's the calendar. The calendars are just, I mean, I think I joke with every appointment that I go to that does like, oh, calendaring is so hard. And they're all like, oh yeah, it's really rough to schedule people. Like, why,
right.
Why is this a thing? It's like a cultural phenomenon now for all of us to just have busy calendars.
It is. I mean, I'll just like my least favorite thing, I'm serving in the parish, hands down, was trying to schedule when we were going to have confirmation class. Because every kid's like, well, I have dance and I have volleyball and I've got travel softball and I'm in a play. And like everybody's doing six different things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And trying to find, it's like, okay, we're going to be meeting at 3 a.m. on Thursdays. That's the only time that works for everyone. It stinks. I hate it.
Yeah. Uh-huh. We call this calendaring. Like we've made it into its own word.
A verb.
Yeah. it's a thing when it's become.
Is that a verb? Well, you know it's bad when you show up at the dentist and start joking about it being your spa day.
Oh.
Because you have 45 minutes there where you just can't be doing anything but laying back in the chair.
Rachel!
Have you ever seen these dentists where you can sleep? The sleep dentist?
I need that dentist.
This
miss out
thing.
On spa day? What?
Right. Yeah, that's a good point.
Nap day.
Right. Nap day.
Yeah.
Okay, but like speaking practically, we all joke about it, but like how do you remove things from the schedule?
We all want to know.
Yeah.
Oh. I love talking about this.
Uh-huh. Good.
It's one of these things like I used to joke at church that my spiritual gift is throwing stuff away because it's so hard to do
right
at church.
To come to my house and help.
That would be great. Right. But along with that, I really am always trying to think about how can we be a little bit more deliberate about this. So just a couple of things. I mean, the first thing is we have to be able to say no, which is so hard. And as Christians, especially if you're of a certain kind of personality, it's like, no, I don't want to displease anyone ever.
Mm-hmm.
So here's a tip that I got from Eugene Peterson, the late pastor and theologian. And he wrote in his book, The Contemplative Pastor, which is totally my jam. He says, in our culture, this was 30 years ago. It's only more true today. In our culture, he says, one of the few things that is sacrosanct is we're calendaring. And like your appointment calendar, you can tell people, hey, I really need to spend some more time with my spouse. And it's just, you know, I appreciate this thing that you're asking me to do, but like, we really just need some quality time. And they'll say, well, you could do that anytime. I really need you to do X, Y, or Z. But he says, if you say my appointment calendar won't allow it, folks will be like, oh, okay. I totally get it. I understand. Like that is inviolable. And there's actually more recently, there's research that backs this where it adds this layer of objectivity to it. And it kind of takes the emotion out of it. Mm-hmm. Like it's not me saying no to you. Mm-hmm. It's just, there's this mean thing, the appointment calendar that won't allow it. And maybe it's on your appointment calendar. It says time with spouse or time with the Lord, whatever. Earlier this year, my wife and I went out to New York City and we went to Teddy Roosevelt's childhood home, my favorite president. My dog's named Theo.
Oh,
I love Teddy. And also for Theophilus, dual name there. But when he was president, he had a standing appointment with his kids every afternoon where they would just do goofy stuff around the house. And it didn't matter if it was the Secretary of State or some diplomat who was like, well, Mr. President, I need to meet with you. He'd be like, sorry. The calendar won't allow, right? I've got a meeting with my boys. So that's one thing.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing along with that is getting out in front of it is adding buffer with your calendar. And the rule of thumb that I like, and it sounds kind of crazy, but it helps, is to add 50% to whatever you think this thing is going to take. This meeting, we think it's going to be an hour, schedule an hour and a half for it. Okay. These errands, I'm going to be able to do it in a couple hours. Well, then schedule 3 hours for it. And a couple of things happen. One, it just naturally creates some buffer. So you're not trying to pack more things in there.
Mm-hmm.
And we're all prone to doing that. We think, oh, I could fill up a little bit more. Or if it doesn't take that long, then it's like a time rebate, which is an incredible feeling where, oh, it really did only take 2 hours. And now I have this hour. I don't have anything scheduled. Maybe I'll read a book. Maybe I'll take a nap. Maybe I'll go to the dentist and have a spa day.
if you can get an appointment.
Well, then exactly.
Not
6 months
first
out.
Choice, but sure.
So, still, yes. Can do that. But saying no, not feeling bad about it, you can't do everything. And Jesus is Lord. You are not. That's okay. And then maybe this goes into another part of the book we can talk about. But then also just adding some buffer to your schedule, and it helps us to outsmart ourselves where we're overly ambitious too often with our calendars.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of that other part of the book, that was another extremely convicting chapter for me. And that was the chapter on blasphemous anxiety. I don't like to think of myself as blasphemous ordinarily,
yes.
But
right.
I, again, felt very convicted reading that chapter. What is blasphemous anxiety?
Yes. So this is a phrase that comes from the early church father, Hilary of Poitiers, who refers to the blasphemous anxiety of trying to do God's work for him.
Mm.
And this is where we start to think, I mean, more often implicitly than explicitly, Lord willing, but we think, hey, if I don't get this done, it'll never get done. I have to fix all the problems. I need to be the solution to all the world's ills. Part of this, Rachel, I think goes back to that finitude thing.
Yes.
Like, can I somehow transcend my human limits and say, well, I am the one who's going to do it. And to be fair, like, everything in our culture tells you that you can, right? That you are going to be able to, that you should not have to encounter limits, right? That you can do all the things. If you just have the right app, you should be able to resolve it all. And yeah, it's wrong. I will say, speaking for those in the ministry context, this can be a special occupational hazard where you're like, oh, I can do all this stuff, and I should, because it's for the Lord and for his people. And it's like, no, Jesus is already the Messiah. That job has been filled. You know, applications are closed. Thank you. And so you don't have to fill it anymore. That's the blasphemous anxiety. And yes, it convicts me too.
Yeah.
The blasphemous anxiety thing. Oh boy, I think that chapter, very convicted. I like to say, oh, of course I can do that thing. It'll be fine. Except it's frequently not fine. Like, I probably can do the things, but I'm going to not be able to do them as well as I want to. Mm-hmm. And I'm probably going to burn myself out. And
yeah.
I have lived long enough that I should know better. And I don't know better. Maybe slowly getting better.
Right.
But there's just this, I don't know, there's this like burning desire to just do all the, why do we think we can just say yes to everything and it'll be fine? Is this a human thing? Is it a cultural thing? Like, all of the above? I don't know.
Yeah, all the above. No, it's a human thing. I mean, culturally, we don't have a whole lot of help in this regard. But like, human nature, why does God give us from the very beginning Shabbat, the Sabbath, where the Hebrew word literally means stop?
Mm.
Yeah, and it's God knows our nature, that our inclination is to think, I need to go all the time.
Yeah.
And that it's up to me. And God's saying, no, I am going to put this on penalty of death, mind you, in the Old Testament, that you are going to stop. You will go to sleep, or I will put you to sleep. You need to rest, because Sabbath embodies the reality that God is the source of our life, not our own activity.
Mm-hmm.
The point of Shabbat, of Sabbath, is that you are going to stop and to receive. And reception is the essence of faith. It's the open hands that receive from the Lord. And so our human nature, our warped and crooked human nature, this side of the fall, thinks that I can always just get ahead by working a little bit harder. And God says, no, you need to stop. You need to rest. Chick-fil-A figured it out. Right. I don't know why the rest of us can. Right. Right?
Mm-hmm. True. Well, be like Chick-fil-A.
Okay. I feel like, but that there gets at one of the things that I think church workers in particular struggle with, maybe even the most. Well,
for sure. You're working. I mean, let's be honest, you're working one day a week, as people would always tell me.
Yeah. But also, like, all the things that are so important. I mean, they're, but we layer on top of it. Oh, it's of eternal importance.
Yes.
Doing it
right.
Jesus. So I can't say no.
It's not just, it's not just, you know.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And this is where, I mean, you're working on the Sabbath.
Yeah.
This is where Luther's helpful with the third commandment, where he reframes it, his explanation. So third commandment, remember the Sabbath day by keeping it holy. Mm-hmm. And his explanation to it, Luther says, well, what does this mean? Well, we should fear and love God so we don't despise preaching in his word, but hold it sacred and gladly hear and learn it. And he reframes it from just a particular day of the week to a receptivity of God's word. That's helpful, especially for those who are in ministry and in church work, to recognize and not feel guilty, like, okay, yeah, on the Sabbath, strictly speaking, I do have to work. But where can I find other times to be carving out that time to rest and receive from the Lord? If you're working on Sunday, then you sure better be taking another day or two off during the week. You need to be carving out that time. Don't think that you are so important and invaluable, indispensable, mm-hmm. that you have to work 7 days a week. We all want to believe that we are totally and utterly indispensable. At the end of the day, the only one who's indispensable is our Lord Jesus himself. And the rest of us, hey, this is part of why, you know, as pastors, you know, something like the vestments that we wear emphasizes theologically the fact that it's not about the man, it's mm-hmm. about the office, right? Or think of Jerry Seinfeld talks about, you know, when there's the wedding ceremony, you don't say, will you marry Bob? You say, will you marry this man? Will you take this man? Because, you know, that's why all the other guys are dressed up, just in case we got to swap them out. It'll just bump. No, just recognizing the sense that ultimately it's the Lord alone and his grace that matters, and it's liberating to recognize it's not all up to me, mm-hmm. even if it can be painful as well to admit it.
Mm-hmm. So you talked about rest. Did we talk yet about work, and particularly working with your hands, which was something that you pulled out of this passage and then I think had a lot of fun with exploring. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I definitely did. Yeah, because I enjoy work, and it's a common place among pastors and teachers to point out that work was there before the fall, yes. right? In Genesis 2, God is giving work to Adam to do. To work and to keep the garden. Work as such is not a bad thing. It's not a punishment. We can experience it as such. We can experience it as toil, and that you're merely going to get your bread by the work of your hands, by the sweat of your brow. But it doesn't have to be that way. And so to talk about working with your hands speaks to our vocations, the ways that we make our livelihood and the good work that God gives us to do. It speaks to those who have blue-collar jobs and are working in occupations that we tend to think of as, you know, trades, and that are more of, I mean, in this culture, that can be second class sometimes, where it's like, well, white-collar professional jobs or knowledge workers, people who are working creative, those are the really interesting occupations where if you are just, you know, in the trades, that's not as important. But I'd be curious to hear from you guys. You know, I write about this in the book. My experience growing up in like a suburban high school was second class. Like if you were going to be a plumber or a mechanic, like, okay, that's fine. You do what you got to do. But that wasn't as spiritual, especially thinking from my Christian context. But even just looking at it from a secular perspective, it wasn't as meaningful. I don't know. What's been your guys' experience in going back to your own upbringing?
So I remember my high school years, we lived in a very small town, and we definitely had it was a lower income part of the state. And we had a significant group of the, I would say, percentage of the high school class that remained to graduate. It declined quite a bit from of who actually graduated. Mm-hmm. And it was a significant percentage that were not going to go on to college and were going to either go on to a vocational school or just go right into some sort of occupation. Mm-hmm. We had two factories in town, and I worked at one for 2 summers during college. That was my college job. And I remember thinking, this really makes me want to graduate. I remember just thinking, I'm like, I do not want this to be my life. And I say that, and I look back on it now and I'm like, that was good, honest work. And it would have been fine to have that be my life. And it would have been a different life. But at the time I looked at it and I was like, oh, I can't imagine having this be my life. I've got to graduate from college. I would just go crazy if this were my life. And that was, to an extent, that was like, I think, immaturity, but also to an extent, also some of that background, I don't know, foundational conditioning or whatever of like what is to be desired. Yeah. And the factory worker was not, I mean, it paid well for a summer job as a college student. It was a good job. It was exhausting, but it gave me a good paycheck. But that I remember thinking that. And as I look back on it now, I do look back on it with a different perspective than I did at that time.
Yeah. And, you know, I think I want to eat my cake and still have it on this one. on the one hand, affirming the fact that, like you said, if you'd stuck at the factory, that could have been meaningful work and an opportunity to find a sense of vocation, to serve your neighbor and to do that work well. And so I wanted to affirm in this section of the book for those who are in jobs that are not so glamorous or interesting, or you're in middle management, or, you know, you're doing something where you're like, this just does not feel like what I, you know, aspired to when I was a kid. And to say that can be good and godly work, even if it's for no other reason than I need to find something to pay the bills to take care of my family. Like that's core to our vocation that should not be overlooked. On the other hand, there's something to be said too for recognizing, hey, it's okay to see how can I be using the gifts and talents that God has given to me, and I want to exercise them. And if you have an opportunity to move into work that is more fulfilling personally and where you feel like your gifts are better used, there's nothing wrong with that either. Yeah. And Paul, I think, does this both in 1 Corinthians 7, where he talks about this. Like, if you have an opportunity, avail yourself to it. Otherwise, you can serve the Lord and glorify him in whatever vocation you're at. And so it is very much a kind of a both and.
Mm-hmm. Well, I really appreciate how in the book you extol the virtues of both working with your hands and famously, or not yet famously, but soon to be famously, tell everyone to mow their own lawns.
Yes.
But also extol the creative work that is often comes straight from your brain. So like both head hand, both head work and hand work are very valuable. And I think for me, looking at the various seasons in my life, the times when I have been working, you know, 40 plus hours a week as an intellectual professional, I come home and at the end of the day, all I want to do is cook, clean, mow my lawn, and maybe practice the piano.
Right.
Whereas when I am engaged in those manual labor efforts more, you know, that factory type job, I come home at the end of the day and all I want to do is write poetry and read great novels, you know. And so realizing that there is a need and a hunger in us for both of those kinds of work and that both kinds are godly and that if you're feeling unbalanced in your life, maybe use some of your free time instead of, you know, devoting it to those screens and devices to look at what is the kind of work that I'm missing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's so helpful. I really like how you put that, that there's a sense of balance that God has wired us to think of working with our hands in two ways. Like on the one hand, it's that sense of, it could be the manual labor, but on the other hand, it's the creative outlets. And it can be, as you say, it might be something that is more tactile, more tangible, but it could also be more creative and where it's not. But both of those are natural expressions of what it means to work with your hands. That I think that for any of us who do have work, like as a teacher, as a professor, so much of my time is in my head and trying to get what's in my head out into the heads of others. And you're right, Rachel. Like, I love cooking and baking for precisely this reason. At the end of the day, I'm like, let me just get into it, throw an apron on, and I find that really gratifying. Is that true for you too, Sarah and Aaron?
Yeah. Yeah. I think this came up in our conversation with Dr. Bierman of how, like, when your work is very head focused, try to find the delightful creative outlets that are more analog hobbies, as Aaron has coined. And if it's the other way around, if you work with your hands all day, maybe your delight in the Lord after your work is done is something that's more like reading or sitting still or something. But yeah, that, I find that very true as well. My hobby is riding my bike, which is a very, you know, active thing. But then my brain's also very busy. I find that a lot in my job too here. Like, there's this nice balance of creating. When we create content, I'm creating things, but then also a lot of time to just kind of think. It's none of it's really with my hands though, which is kind of a problem. I can't like mold a podcast out of clay.
But I mean, you think about it, like so many, I don't know, in my experience, you guys can say if it's for you, but so many of my ideas, I won't say they're my best ideas or not, but ideas come through when I'm walking or riding a bike
or
doing other things, mowing the lawn, all of that kind of stuff. But Aaron, I have the delight of seeing you work with your hands on the regular because I sit behind Aaron at church.
Oh,
and yeah. I can.
Does she bring her knitting still?
Over her shoulder, and she brings her knitting oftentimes.
Yes.
And so I know that you enjoy working with your hands. How do you find that satisfying?
I do. I found, like, I had a gap of time where that wasn't like an intentional part of my life, but then I hit a season where the work that I had, I felt there was no opportunity for any creativity. It was a weird season, but anyway, it was a very stifling season, and I sort of in desperation decided I was just going to take. I took up two hobbies simultaneously, and I sometimes joke. I'm like, there were worse ways I could have chosen to manage this stress, but it was not necessarily the healthiest approach either. Like, it could have been way worse, but I threw myself into it fully, into both of these hobbies. Like, it took up it filled all the free time, but it was a response, sort of a response against that. And as the stress in other ways eased, then I found I was able to actually go back to seeking a little better balance in those areas as well.
Sure.
But I do continue to, I love the opportunity to make something with my hands and see. I think that is also something that I find so satisfying because often with work, I have some, not always, but there is often things where it's like, you can't really see, did you finish it? Did you do it?
That's right.
How it's like, it's never done. Like the work is never done. It's never finished. You finish one thing, but there's another
podcast
one
to post.
Like, there's always three projects in various stages of completion, and you finish one and there's still two others and another one is starting. And so you never get the sense of like, I did it.
Yeah.
But with things that you make, you do get that. And it is a very satisfying feeling. And then you get as you said, like, you get the Sabbath, you get to be able to sit back and rest from all of that periodically. And it's just a satisfying feeling.
Yeah,
totally.
As we talk about Sabbath, and I know Dr. Bierman's name has come up a few times, this gives me a perfect segue into some questions that we have from our listeners in the Lutheran Ladies Lounge. The first one actually mentions Dr. Bierman's book.
Right.
So
we've had it for you a few times. That's why.
Oh yeah. No,
it's my neighbor actually, down the hall. So I can go grab him right now.
No, actually that is what we want to know. This listener says, I read Bierman's Day 7 book and noticed that there are some overlapping sources mentioned in both books, though they approach those sources from different angles. I'm curious if Dr. Tinetti and Dr. Bierman had discussions about these topics and sources.
So discussion would mean both of us were talking.
Go on.
What I mean by that is, so Dr. Bierman was my teacher when I was a student.
Okay.
And so I have very much been formed by his own teaching, like when I was a student at the seminary. And so he has helped to shape and form me as the theologian that I am today. And so it's no accident that there would be those sorts of influences. Now, I wish that I had been able to interact more with his book and so forth as I was writing mine, and just the timelines of them overlap such that didn't work out. Mm-hmm. And so we didn't have a whole lot of it. He got an advanced copy of it though, and we talked about it, and he's like, I mean, Ryan, we're saying the same thing from different angles.
Yeah.
And one of the best compliments I got, I think I can share this, is he said that he shared my book with his dad, who's a retired pastor and an elderly gentleman. And he said, yeah, this is just what is true for any of us, what we need to hear. And that was a great word of affirmation to hear it even from Mr. Bierman, the senior. But yes, there's definitely a lot of continuity with our thought.
Okay. So there were no inkling style, like discussions around the table at the pub before these books were published, but there is nonetheless
yes.
a continuity influence. Of thought
yes.
influence.
Yeah.
All right.
Maybe for future books, there'll be more of that inkling.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we're on to you. We know that there are parallels between them.
I think that should make us confident in like the books that we read from people too, that you guys didn't really talk about it, but we're still reading the same things. Our mm-hmm. theology all holds together
yes.
mm-hmm. very yep. well, even from different perspectives.
Yeah.
We all
right.
still end up saying the same
yeah.
thing. I think that makes me feel very confident in the things that we're
yeah.
reading, the applications that we're making when we're reading right. these kinds of things. Because sometimes the Christian living things can get a little wooey, you know, and mm-hmm.
yeah.
this is actually what our doctrine says. But yeah, yes, we multiple people
I mean,
saying the same thing.
If it's too novel, it's probably heresy.
And so, that's true.
We're trying to say, to tell the whole old story in fresh ways and to draw out implications for our present time. But if we're saying something that's too new, that there should be something about that. They're like, I'm not sure about
right.
that.
Yeah.
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 We don't want heresy. Not today.
Okay. We have another question here from another listener. And this is an interesting question. We talked a little bit earlier about the introvert-extrovert problem.
Man.
She asks, mm-hmm. what advice does he have for those of us who don't need any encouragement to live quietly, who might take those words as an excuse to stay in our comfortable little hermit holes? So what would you
yes.
say to people who are already like well into living quietly and maybe
yes.
it's a problem?
Mm. Yep, that's right. So this is where, again, I tried to push myself. That was the book that I thought would be really easy, like, okay, just renounce all ambition and go into your little hermit hole and life is great and so much easier. You know, I'm going to go and fashion my coffee table and just avoid the world and it'll be fine. But the deeper I thought about it, the more I realized, and looking at the scriptures, is that there reward for faithfulness in the scriptures is not retirement, it's responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the Lord doesn't just say, I mean, there's a time when he says, well done, good and faithful servant, and, you know, enter into the joy of your master. But Paul says, I would rather depart and be with Christ, for that would be far better. He hasn't taken me yet. And so what does that mean? Well, then it continues to mean fruitful service for me.
Mm-hmm.
It means that the Lord still has something for me. So I would encourage, and in the latter part of the book, I tell an anecdote from the life of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, mm-hmm. who will be familiar with for many of your listeners. Maybe you brought this up in the first edition, but he was someone who was in a season of life. This was in the 1930s, before everything went down, where there was conspiracy on Hitler and all of the ways he got pulled into that Sturm und Drang, you might have said.
Mm-hmm.
But that it was a time when he was just a pastor in the suburbs of London, and he was living quietly. And it was like, this is great. I don't have to worry about all the craziness that's happening back in Germany. And he did that for a couple of years. But one of his mentors and friends basically called him out
mm-hmm.
and said, hey, listen, this is nice for you, Dietrich. I'm glad that you're being able to, and he even said, living this quiet life. but why are you playing Jonah right now when we need you? When he said something to the effect of, your house is on fire. You have what it takes to be able to help. Get your tush on the first boat back here and, and do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, this is Dietrich Bonhoeffer. It's not all of us. And our situations aren't typically that extreme. However, I do think for any of us, if we find ourselves getting just a little bit too comfortable to the point of complacency, it might be the time when we might say, okay, I should hear from some wise mentors or friends in my life who can speak into it to say, hey, are there ways that I could be serving that you think I'm not? Are there things that I, gifts that God has given to me that I could be sharing that perhaps I'm keeping to myself a little bit too much? So my word would be, it's not bad, but to recognize, Paul says, yeah, I make it my ambition, whether I'm at home or away, that I would please the Lord. And so long as we are in the Lord's army, we are always on standing reserves and we serve at his pleasure. And he has a way of finding us. God knows your address, and to be open to the ways that he is going to call upon you to serve. So.
It's interesting. You mentioned in the book that Jonah was living quietly when he was in the belly of the whale.
That's right. Exactly. Exactly. I actually don't know what it's like to be in the belly of the whale. So it's probably really loud, but it was more of a poetic truth, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's also probably an open seat on church councils. If you say, hey, I think I want to serve in this way on a board at church, I'm pretty sure somebody is going to take you up on that. So
this saying is correct.
There's probably
right.
a way to serve.
Oh, that's no right. doubt. No doubt. Speaking of serving at church, I have a pair of questions here about church workers. And we've talked about this a little bit, but I just want to revisit it while we're still here. One listener asks, how does an overcommitted person take a step back when doing so would mean the tasks wouldn't get done in a ministry setting? All right, so there's one question. I'm going to throw this other one out here and you can tackle them both at once. Another listener says, how do we actively support pastors and other church leaders who are working so hard with so little help to embrace quiet ambition?
Yeah, so, God bless you. Yes.
What do we say to the church workers who are struggling and the people who are watching them struggle and not quite sure what to do?
Good. Thank you for putting those questions together, because there can be a mutually reinforcing thing where pastors, DCEs, folks serving in ministry in whatever capacity, you can have the sense, as the questioner said, like, if I don't do this, it's not going to get done. Like, it's going to drop. The short answer is some things should drop. Yeah, and this is really hard. This is really painful. Mm-hmm. But if the plate is so full that it's groaning under that weight to the point of dropping, that's the Lord telling us through our natural limitations that there's too much on there. And we are loath ever to let anything drop off. But that's part of that recognition that, okay, we can't do everything. Now, where the other side of it is, as church workers and so forth, we can feel a sense of importance by taking all those things on. And like, if I'm doing all of that, then I must really matter. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not going to just say, oh, this is all, if all of those people in church would stop asking so much of us, then we would be able to take a break. And in some cases that might be true, but it can be just as often true. Like, hey, you need to check yourself and say, do I really need to do all these things, or am I just wanting to feel like I'm really needed?
Mm-hmm.
So on the flip side, then I would say for congregation members and for those who love and support their church workers is really holding them accountable to taking days off and respecting that.
Mm-hmm.
And so one thing that I forget where I learned this from, but it served me really well. I wouldn't say that as a pastor, like such and such day is my day off. I'd say this is my family day. And so people would respect that. Oh, it's right. just your day off, Pastor. I'm coming to get you. Or, you know, if you don't have a family, it's like, this is a personal day. This is my day with the Lord. Like, this is my Sabbath with the Lord. And then for the person taking that day, like, really, you need to legit turn your phone off, put an away message on your email, not check those things, have some kind of system where if you're fortunate to have like a church secretary, like if it's a genuine emergency, reach out to me. But those are a lot fewer and farther between than we right. oftentimes like to think. So Yeah, taking vacation and doing for your church worker like my elder did for me and saying, you look and sound like you're about to be burnt out. You need to take a vacation and enforcing that.
And comp days at church.
Yeah.
I remember when my husband was in the parish, his day off was inviolate unless there was a wedding or a funeral, in which case he just could go weeks without actually taking the day off because one thing after another. But to enshrine the idea of if you work on your day off, you absolutely take a comp day.
Yeah.
And we will enforce this for you because, yeah, you're right. You do get hung up on this. It won't happen without me here.
Yeah.
But it probably will for at least a day.
It probably will. In almost every case, it probably will. This, it's a hard word, but it's ultimately a liberating word.
Yeah. And I mean, I can think even from... I don't know. I don't work for a congregation. I work for, the LCMS headquarters. Mm. So we're a company. And I remember I've had these conversations through the years, and sometimes I have to remind myself of the conversation that I've had with other people. But the idea that, if we are consistently having people extend themselves beyond the norm, it gives a false sense of what our needs are. It gives a false sense of what the actual need is. If we see that we can get it done with this many people,
right,
then why would we make how do we make a case for hiring additional people if we're able to actually get it done with the staff we have? We're being good stewards, right? But then if you burn the people out, then that's not a good steward, and then you don't have anyone to do it, and that's not a good approach. And while I feel like that's more applicable at the larger scale of a company sort of thing, where you sometimes get that, you can get that sort of, you don't notice it because there's more people. And so you just press them further and it's maybe a little more obvious. I haven't worked in a small setting like a congregation before, but I have a feeling there's more parallels there. And it gives a false sense of what is actually reasonable if you have somebody stretched to the limits as the norm. Mm-hmm. So
I think that's a great point. And I mean, having been a pastor of a small congregation, I know you can be relied upon to do everything. And it's, again, it can really inflate your sense of self. Like, okay, if I'm the one who's responsible for all this, but there's some of those things that maybe just don't need to be done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think we talked about similar too, that when I let go of something that I can do, like I have the talent to do a thing, I don't necessarily have to do it. Right. When you let that go, you're also allowing other people to step up actually serve in a way. So holding on to everything myself is actually really selfish of me.
Totally.
I think that I have to do it all instead of letting go. I'm preaching to myself right now. Instead of letting go of my friends will know. Instead of letting go of things so that other people can also serve, mm-hmm. because we want other people to be able to serve in the ways that they're able to serve. And everybody is able to serve in different ways. Yeah.
Yep. So. Great point.
So I know we are running up against a little bit of a deadline here for wrapping up our conversation, because one of us has some calendaring to do this afternoon.
All right, I got to go to seminary for my class.
Right. But before we wrap up completely, I want to ask if there was one thing that you wanted people to take away from this book, what would it be? And there's a lot to choose from here, but what's the one thing?
So, good question. And it's always, it's a challenge for an author. You're like, I wrote all these words. They all, all of them matter. Don't you understand?
The whole book, Rachel, that's the one thing.
That's the whole thing. That's right. No, but in the concluding chapter, I riff off of a quote from, you mentioned him before, Wendell Berry, one of my favorite authors. And some 50 years ago, he said that the mantra in our culture for the longest time has been think big, think big, think big. He said, we're at a point where a much more helpful and necessary word is think little. Mm. And I think there's a lot of application for that. But for us as Christians to think little, to recognize that the Lord is operative in all of the day-to-day things that might seem to be insignificant, but from the perspective of heaven may in fact be like the widow's mite of invaluable worth. We don't know. And so if there's one particular word I would leave with us, it's think little. What are those moments in my day, those interactions, whether it be with a frustrated child or a harried customer or the guy that you pass when you're walking down the street who never seems to lift up his eyes? What are those little moments in my day where I can maybe be able to bring, like Jesus said, a little cup of cool water? Mm-hmm. And that might be the difference between a good day and a bad day. And to show the Lord's love in those little moments, it adds up to a lot, I think.
Oh, that's beautiful. Thank you. Dr. Dinady, thank you for spending time with us today to talk about your book. We have all enjoyed it very much. And we didn't know how much we needed it when we picked it for our book club. But we have had a great time. And while as we record this, the book club discussion on our Facebook group is still ongoing, I can tell you that the interactions there have been very stimulating and inspiring to me personally. So thank you for getting this conversation started and for participating in it so actively yourself.
Mm-hmm. My pleasure. Thank you so much for the opportunity. I'm honored.
It's been really great to have you with us. Where can we find your book?
Wherever, middling books are sold. Wherever fine books are sold. Online. It's published from InterVarsity Press. Mm-hmm. So you can go right to the publisher or bookshop.org, get it through your local bookstore, or of course, Amazon. All of those places are, it's available.
Very good. Very good. We'll post links and things and everything in the show notes for the episode. Of course, as we always do, you can join us in our Facebook group to find the past posts now when this episode drops of this book club. If you'd like to join in the discussion there, you can still do that. It'll be under the past events in our Facebook group. You can also find the book club questions posted on our Instagram from a couple of weeks ago. If you scroll down a little bit, you'll find them at Lutheran Ladies Lounge. You can follow us there as well. You can find all of our episodes at KFUO.org/Lutheran Ladies Lounge or on your favorite podcasting app or on the KFUO radio app. You're listening to the Lutheran Ladies Lounge podcast. I'm Sarah.
I'm Erin.
And I'm Rachel.
Views and opinions expressed on the Lutheran Ladies Lounge podcast may not represent the official position of the management or ownership of KFUO Radio, the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. The Lutheran Ladies Lounge is produced by KFUO Radio and available at KFUO.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to hit that subscribe button and leave a review for us, too. If you love the Lutheran Ladies Lounge podcast, consider financially supporting our producer, KFUO Radio, so we can keep doing what we do. Find out how at KFUO.org/give.
I'm going to have to actually step out here for about 30 seconds. Apparently, there's a man at the door. But please, Erin and Sarah, ask a question and I will be back in just a sec.